Welcome to the Doomer Optimism Podcast. I am here, Ashley, with friend of the show, Chris Mage, and esteemed guest, Dugald Hine. I will have you introduce yourself, Dugald, and then we will jump into a little bit of a longer conversation about your book and where we go from here. Thanks for being here.
Well, hi, Ashley. Thanks for having me on. And yeah, greetings from Östervåla, Sweden, which is where I'm based these days. And how do you want me to introduce myself? Let's see. I guess some people who follow Doomer Optimism might have come across the Dark Mountain Project, which I started with Paul Kingsnorth back in 2009. Paul and I had both worked as journalists. We'd both been involved in the environmental movement. We were both writers. We'd both arrived at a kind of place of disillusionment with each of those trajectories, I think it's fair to say. And we had a sense that, at least back then, there was a gap between the sort of the ways that we were encouraged to express ourselves, the feelings we were encouraged to have in the movements that we'd been part of, where it was okay to be angry at them, the people who are destroying the planet. And it was okay to like cheer each other on and provide encouragement. But if you were called a doomer in those days, no one would have connected it with optimism. And generally, when we wrote the manifesto, people would say to us, look, we get it, guys, you're burned out, but like, don't go around talking to everyone about it. Like, go and disappear to a beach somewhere and like get over your burnout, and maybe you'll have enough energy left to come back and do another round, or maybe it's time to move to Devon and retrain as an acupuncturist. But there was no sense that there might actually be something helpful in confronting the failure of our hopes, the failure of the promises and the narratives that we'd ended up buying into as environmentalists, that we maybe needed to confront the extent to which the trouble the world is in is a predicament that we need to fathom and to find ways of living in response to, rather than a problem that can be solved and everything can be made okay. And so I guess we were trying to open up that space when we started Dark Mountain. And that led to lots of books and festivals and collaborations, and led to me spending a lot of time going around talking about climate change, actually. But when I came across what you guys were doing with Doomer Optimism a few years ago, I had a sense of kinship that, this reminded me of the kind of space of conversation that we were trying to open up when we wrote the manifesto. So yeah, it's good to be with you both.
Nice. Thank you. I would definitely like unequivocally say Dark Mountain has been super influential for a lot of the people who are in the space. Like, at that time, not a lot of people were just kind of sort of processing like the state of the problem or the gravity of the problem that we're all facing, or the various different problems. And I guess it would be interesting, I kind of like as an arc of the show, to first kind of lay out the doom and then move toward the optimism. It's just kind of a natural progression. So I'm wondering if we could lay out a little bit of the doom, not necessarily climate change, which I feel like almost all of our listeners are aware, we've been made aware, but also what you talk about in the book to some extent. I think there is a subset of people who are sort of stuck in a kind of nihilism or like endless doomerism, and I just wonder if you might talk about I think the doomer optimism thing for us is a lot of us have sort of gone through those stages, like almost like stages of grief, where you've gone through versus like, oh no, this isn't really happening, or there's bargaining, like, okay, well, maybe we can just get some solar panels and then it'll be okay. And then the acceptance stage, which is like, whoa, this is actually a really big loss. There's a really big change happening here. And then whatever happens beyond that acceptance stage is like what we're all grappling with. So let's dig into that.
Yeah, right. I mean, that was a pretty good description. I sometimes say that for a lot of the people who were drawn to the heart of Dark Mountain, a lot of the people I worked with during the decade or so where that was really at the heart of my work, Dark Mountain became a kind of journey to the far side of despair, where instead of treating despair as a thing to be avoided at all costs, you treat it as something which is kind of forced on you if you're not going to, you know, just stay in denial or in forms of action that are really forms of distraction to keep you from thinking about the thoughts that come in the middle of the night. But also that despair is not or need not be an end in itself. I mean, yes, it is possible to get stuck there. It's possible to get stuck in a kind of doom loop of, you know, Facebook will happily serve you all of these salami slices of the apocalypse. And at a certain point in time, you need to stop reading all of those articles because you know enough. You've got enough of a feel for the depth of the trouble we're in. And actually, you need to start learning how to look around the edges of the way it tends to be framed in the ways that it's served up to you. One of the working titles for this book, it went through a lot of titles before we landed on one that actually worked. But one of the not quite working titles was The Kind of Hope Worth Having. Because I say a couple of times in the book, you know, the kind of hope worth having is not this sort of desperate optimism of trying to keep the fears and the darkness at bay. It is the kind of hope that might just be waiting for you on the far side of that passage through despair. And my publisher in Vermont said, absolutely not. We cannot have hope in the title. And I realized after a few conversations with people in North America, like, I don't know, maybe this is like a post-Obama thing or something. Yeah. Like the whole language of hope is just so burnt out that you have to start from somewhere else. But I, you know, I definitely relate to the sort of trajectory that you're describing there, that kind of trajectory through doom to something, whatever we want to call it, hope or optimism or remaining open to surprise on the far side of it.
I'll let Chris go, but I just want to briefly say this again. I think I've said it once on the podcast. I totally got burnt out with the word hope. Because of Obama, I was like a huge Obama organizer. And then I got so burnt out because it was like, yes, we can hope. And then he was like super neoliberal once he got into office. And I was like, this hope thing is just, it's just a projection. It's just, you're projecting your own fantasy onto this word hope. And like, you know, so then I think subconsciously why I used the term optimism accidentally when I made me and Jason made this term doomer optimism. So I just want to like be clear about that. When I use the word optimism, I'm thinking like of a agency-based move toward something. But anyway, so Chris, sorry, you go ahead.
Sure. Yeah. Well, maybe just to build on the bit of discussion you've had. I mean, I really, really liked your book, Dougal. It's great. And I mean, I read, I feel like I need to read it two or three more times to really kind of plumb its depths, which is great because, you know, one of the things I really like about it is that it's kind of serious and also open, and you know, it's not offering sort of quick and easy answers. And you know, I think there's this, you know, building on that conversation you just had, I think, you know, there is this kind of publishing tendency to say, you know, there's all these terrible things going on. Look how awful it all is. But fortunately, da-da, you know, if you follow my 3-point plan, everything will be great. And, you know, I really like the way that you refuse that narrative and, you know, you do find causes for, you know, for getting out of bed and sort of dealing with the problems, but not that kind of false, easy. I mean, solutionism is a word that keeps popping into my mind where, I mean, you know, you talk a lot about science, which is great, and the difficulties that a lot of us have around science, you know, not that we want to question the, you know, the sort of basic practices of science, but the way that science is kind of rhetorically deployed. So there's a lot of great stuff there. But I mean, I suppose, you know, one thing that resonated to me when I was doing publicity stuff for my own book is kind of just building on the point you've been discussing where, you know, I would talk about, you know, A Small Farm Future, the title of my book, and people would be like, yeah, great. You know, we need localism. We need small farms. You know, humanity is facing this existential crisis. We're on the point of extinction. But then it's almost like, yeah, but we're still going to be flying around the world and sort of having holidays in the Mediterranean or whatever. I mean, you know, I exaggerate a bit, but you know what I mean? So there's almost this disconnect. And I guess I feel it myself in my own life a little bit So I just wondered, yeah, you know, what I think you talk about really nicely in the book is trying to move beyond that. And, you know, you have various why I'm no longer talking to people about climate change as a sort of phrase, or, you know, just trying to move beyond that kind of easy solutionism. And that's, you know, that's where I think the doomer optimism thing is so great. And Ashley's original question, you know, in order to have any kind of realistic optimism, you've first got to embrace the doom. So yeah, I'd be interested if you know, for you to talk a little bit about that and maybe ground it in some of the discussions you have about science around climate change or around COVID, you know, the our over easy recourse to solutions, I think, is something that's kind of hobbling us as we confront the difficulties.
Thanks, Chris. I mean, firstly, I write back at you because your book was one of the books that made it possible for me to write this one. And yeah, I mean that completely sincerely. And really, there are kind of, when I think about the field of possibility out of which this book came, A Small Farm Future is one of the kind of, one of its kind of close neighbors. And the other book that comes up a lot along the way for me is Vanessa Machado de Oliveira's Hospicing Modernity. Mm-hmm. And sort of reading your two books alongside each other, you know, what was powerful for me about that is that you don't, like, you're not drawing on the same sources. You didn't necessarily know each other's work, but you find yourself arriving at this kind of similar diagnosis of the kind of deep root of the trouble we're in, where you say in your book, like, this, the cultural crisis that's like the 10th on your list of 10 crises, the best name we can give it is modernity. And that's kind of what I'm talking about in the book. And something that Vanessa says that, like, it took me a couple of years of like being in conversation with her and hearing her say this before it really landed. But she was always using this phrase, presently unimaginable futures. And that thing that you describe where people are like all on board with the kind of happy localism, small farm future, and assuming that somehow we get to keep all the bits we like of the way we live now, or the way that a lot of people around us live now. To me, that's precisely what Vanessa is inviting us to stay with the trouble of when she talks about the futures worth working for being presently unimaginable. And they're presently unimaginable because in order for them to become imaginable, we have to become other than who we are. We have to go through a process of being changed. And that's sort of what I'm talking about in the book, is when you stop treating climate change as a problem that can be fixed and made to go away, and therefore as something that simply needs scientific and technocratic solutions, then, you know, well, kind of two things can happen. One is you can end up in this place of flat despair or just sort of a loop of panic. And I think we need to help people find a way out of that. Mm-hmm. But the other place you can go is you get this encounter with climate change as something that's calling us into question, calling our stories and our identities and our sense of who we are into question, our sense of where it's all going, what kind of world it is, what the shape of history is. And I think that's why I stuck with going around talking, getting involved in lots of conversations about climate change for so long, was because for the people who are most sheltered from the shadow sides of modernity, from, you know, the consequences that have been falling on the lives of lots of people for generations. And you wrote really powerfully about this in your disputes with the eco-modernists a few years ago, Chris, this thing of no one's living in the past. Like, everyone in the world today is, we're all contemporaries, and some of us are living with a disproportionate amount of the benefits of modernity and the current world system, and far more people are living with a disproportionate amount of the costs. But for those who are living with the benefits, I saw, particularly after the beginning of the sort of 2018, 2019 climate movements, this wave of people being destabilized in a kind of almost initiatory way,
yep,
pulled across a threshold into this sense of people's identities and narratives being shaken at a really deep level in a way that can be very, very generative if it's held well and held with care. And I suppose during the pandemic, and this is why I write so much about science in the book, I began to realize that there's also a trap going on, where we'd had this kind of rhetoric of unite behind the science in Fridays for the Future and XR, and then, you know, suddenly in 2020 we had following the science as the kind of rhetoric behind which the difficult judgments that politicians, I think mostly in good faith, were having to make about how to respond to this new disease and what they were being told about it. Like those, that exercise of judgment was being hidden behind the authority of science. And having actually spent quite a lot of time hanging out with climate scientists and having the kind of conversations you have when you go to the pub with them, rather than the things they say on stage when they are, you know, in front of a public audience, or the kind of things they can put into a scientific paper. Oh, I don't think science is well served by the sort of authority and the sort of politicization of it that has been going on, both within the climate movements and within the way that the mainstream of public policy and the people who generally like to see themselves as being on the right side of history, saying kind of believe in the science. We need to believe in the science. It's like, wait a minute, there's a category error going on here when science is being treated as an object of belief. And the actual work of science, which I have a lot of time for, with, you know, with some caveats we could put around it, is not well served by that, and requires instead a kind of a humbling move, an invitation to come down to earth rather than, you know, be hyped up and blown up and turned into something that it's not, in the way that I think a lot of rhetoric in the last few years has done. And that got me to the point of going, actually, you know, we probably need to start from different places rather than assuming that talking about climate change is going to get us to that kind of initiatory being called into question process that I had been seeing going on a few years ago under the sort of new regime of the sort of politicization of science that we now have.
I wait, Chris, I think we should get into, if you're comfortable with it, Chris has had a couple back and forth exchanges with George Monbiot, and I feel like George is a very, like, the prototype of the eco-modernist who is like, follow the science straight toward, like, corporate hegemony. And I have this term that I came up with after having, you know, more or less been a city person, sociologist, studying the environment, thinking about, like, what the suggestions for, like, the correct environmental actions would be. And then seeing, like, you know, moving to Uruguay, seeing small scale producers doing things regeneratively, and the disconnect between those, like, what is suggested actions versus, like, what's actually happening on the ground, and how action should be totally specific and local and all this stuff. I came up with this term, spreadsheet brain, because I think there is totally a brain worm where, you know, if you see things through the spreadsheets, and those spreadsheets, of course, are calculated using certain data sets and assumptions about how to run the data, then you come to a specific set of outcomes, which can in some ways be hegemonic or authoritarian or X, Y, and Z, but it's like a follow the science thing. And so, Chris, I don't know if you want to briefly bring that up, because we're going to have a separate interview where you talk about your forthcoming work on that. But
yeah, sure. Well, yeah, I agree. I mean, it's funny. I used to write this little column. I think you referenced it somewhere, Dougal, for Statistics Views. I mean, I'm not a trained statistician, but I've done a certain amount of social statistical stuff over time, and I wrote this thing, and you know, more or less every one of my pieces was essentially a sort of riff on, was it Disraeli with his, you know, there are lies, damned lies, and statistics. I mean, I don't want to knock numbers. I mean, I think, you know, I use them the whole time, and I mess around with spreadsheets a lot. I love them. my guilty confession here, but they do, you know, all they ever do is, you know, they don't give you any answers. And I totally agree with what you just said, Ashley. You know, they also, you know, they can be useful for generating more questions. They don't give you definitive answers. And there's a lot of things that, you know, as you try and quantify them, they just slip between your fingers, you know, and that the fact that it's kind of hegemonic, the fact that it's certain types of questions and certain types of framings that that you can address through them is such an important point to make. And I mean, in a way, that leads into my little follow-on question I was going to ask Dougal, because I think one of the problems that I have and that, you know, that we're sort of going around with here and that you touch on in your book is that it's so much easier to be an eco-modernist. You know, if somebody kind of says, you know, well, we've got these terrible problems, what can we do about them? It's so much easier to say, oh, nuclear power or, oh, you know, or manufactured food. trying to say, well, you know, there's a problem with how we're framing this, you know, we need to be more, you know, we need to sort of move through despair, we need to, you know, we need to sort of change the narrative. It all sounds kind of a bit vague and wishy-washy to a lot of people because we've been so grounded exactly in that kind of spreadsheet brain sort of thing. And you know, one way I've responded to that over the years, you know, because I've just been a sort of blogger and, you know, my own little person on my homestead, I basically have refused that narrative and sort of said, well, you know, obviously we need 99% of people to be farming with, you know, zero fossil fuel, you know, not take seriously the invitation to kind of come up with a technical solution. But, you know, that means that you're easily ridiculed and you're just, you know, sort of sidelined from the conversation. So I suppose my question is, you know, on the basis of your thinking about this, Dougal, you know, when and you know, you're great, you know, at public speaking and occupying all these spaces, when somebody says, okay, so, you know, eco-modernism, that's not going to work, you know, the numerical answer, there is no numerical answer, so, you know, so what would you do? You know, how do we answer that question in a kind of sound bitey way that, you know, you were talking about, you know, with the climate movement recently, people wanting to, you know, if people were held, it would be generative. So what is that process of holding? You know, how could the three of us, you know, in our sort of communication, how can we hold people better?
Yeah.
What a great question. I mean, obviously, I do get asked that question, or sometimes people don't even ask it because they can see that it would sound a bit silly in the light of what I've been saying. And yet I can see it's kind of there in their heads because they know that they will be asked it if they try to pass on what they're getting from what I'm saying. And so what I always say is when the, what are you saying we should do question is asked, there's always this implication that there ought to be a once and for all answer, that the answer to what should we do should be the kind of answer that can be contained in you know, the sort of size of nonfiction book that mainstream publishers like to publish, with, you know, a set of chapters leading up to a kind of blueprint where if only everyone would listen to what it says in this book, then we could fix it all. And that just, like, bringing into view the absurdity of that and bringing it gently into view, like not as an object of mockery exactly, but recognizing that we're all kind of coming out of that. Like, that's why, like, the eco-modernist kinds of answers, which, you know, someone like George, like, in fairness, I think he's arrived through his own desperation at something very close to eco-modernism, having been a critic of eco-modernism further back in time. But I think he's arrived there because his work has always been saturated in these deep assumptions of modernity, which are invisible because they're the water of the societies we've all been swimming in for so long. And so then in order to bring that, you know, the composition of that water into view, we need to approach it from multiple directions. So on the one hand, I think that your sort of spreadsheet brain description of the ways that lots of us were taught in school to think and the ways that some of us are kind of predisposed to think, I think that can, you can do a lot with Ian McGilchrist's work on, you know, the left brain and the right brain, the master and his emissary. And I haven't read his new, even bigger book, The Matter with Things, yet, but I went to visit him when I was in the UK last month and recorded a conversation where we were starting to dig into some of this, because I think it gives us a helpful framework, not least because the story that McGilchrist is building up, on the one hand from neuroscience and on the other hand from the sort of history of Western philosophy and culture, is one in which the answer is not to throw away the spreadsheets. The answer is that the spreadsheet side of the brain, in his terms, you know, the left brain, is the servant rather than the master in a healthy dynamic. Mm-hmm. You know, it comes after the direct experience of the world, and it does a useful simplification, but there isn't a deeper, truer version of what the world is like. And it's useful to the extent that its fruits are passed back to the part of us that sees the world as alive and full of flow rather than a kind of dead mechanistic thing, which is the way that spreadsheet brain looks at it. And I mean, you can also get to this from elsewhere in the social sciences, from, you know, James C. Scott's Seeing Like a State.
Yeah.
And this kind of history of the necessary kind of radically reductive, the sort of brutal simplifications, first in how the world is seen, and secondly in how the world is arranged on the basis of that way of seeing the world, that have made up modernity. And how, if you're trying to see it all from the center of a modern state and manage it all from above, then it's impossible to conceive of how you could do it other than those reductions, other than seeing the world as a spreadsheet. And what's lacking from that is precisely, you know, that word you used earlier, Ashley, when you were talking about your understanding of optimism, which is agency, mm-hmm. a sense that the agency might not lie with the people in the rooms, you know, the very smart people who went to the kind of university that I went to and who spend their time in the kind of the summit rooms and the rooms where policy gets made, that actually a humbler role for, you know, those of us who spend some of our time in those rooms might be called for, and an assumption that if things are going to turn out better than it mostly looks like, it might not be down to, you know, that one startup in Finland with the funding who promise you that they can feed everyone on the genetically modified microbes. Like, the 2 billion people who live in peasant farming households in the world right now might have something to do with it. And I really, really just want to, like, bring those things into view and say, look, isn't it strange that these lenses of modernity make it so easy to sound reasonable and convincing when you say, oh, those 2 billion people are going to be gone soon, and that startup is going to be like the model of how it's all going to work in 10 or 20 years' time. Like, what makes it possible to say that and be taken seriously is a set of assumptions. And once those assumptions are revealed rather than hidden, it gets increasingly difficult to take that seriously. So there is a kind of, I guess Ivan Illich is kind of in the background of so much of my thinking. And one of the things I love about Illich is there's a kind of wild humor in so much of his writing and speaking, and like a kind of fierce humor that is about, you know, naming the absurdity. Illich is very much the kind of the little boy who points out that the emperor has no clothes. And I think that, you know, when we're invited to go, well, what's your plan then, in response to the spreadsheet brain approach, like, we have to gently, kindly decline the invitation to play that rather absurd game. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as gently and kindly as possible, with humor, bring the absurdity of what is being taken seriously within that game into view in such a way that it might even give some of the people who are playing that game but quietly aware of its absurdity permission to take a few steps in our direction and at least have quiet conversations with people who are involved in the work that the three of us are involved in. And I'm surprised by how much of that is actually happening for me as a result of writing this book.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people are just really curious at this moment. I would say, to answer your question, Chris, we don't always agree on rhetorical strategy on Twitter, but I think it's actually kind of fun to poke at it, the extreme, in the opposite extreme. Like, yeah, we'll just rely on this one startup in Finland is a perfect example. And then the if you can do it right and maintain your composure, have some sort of like dialectic where you have one extreme and then the other extreme, and then we meet in the middle. And, you know, like, for example, make fun of spreadsheet brain. I got a perfect meme where it's like a tumor on somebody's head and it just says inoperable and it's just a spreadsheet. And I love it. But then I also defend the tools of science. Like, you know, if you're going to do surveys and statistical analyses, just because sometimes peer review is not functioning well right now in our society doesn't mean that those tools aren't useful in some cases. And so
well, that's that. I mean, that's what I love about your work, Chris, actually, is that you have the sort of both the chops and the respect for the usefulness of the spreadsheet side of the brain, and can speak about that with more authority than, you know, a lot of the people who are laying out these kind of cornucopian kind of supposedly spreadsheet based stories of how it's all going to work out. But I have to say, I'm really glad that the two of you are on Twitter, so I don't have to be, because I like, once upon a time, I had a deep and meaningful relationship with Twitter, circa 2009, 10, 11. I don't even go there anymore, but it warms my heart to know that you guys are there fighting the good fight.
Well, Ashley is the real expert. It's the language, you know. I feel like I'm a sort of language learning student. I don't, you know, I look at some tweets, I don't even know what the hell it means.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, Ashley,
I'm the mimetic. Right. I'm the mimetic expert. I'll control that domain if you guys don't mind.
Yeah, but that's it. Just to sort of follow up on your answer, I mean, yeah, it's really interesting. And I think one of the things I like your answer about sort of being playful, playfully challenging. I mean, one thing I've encountered a lot with, you know, eco-modernist type stuff is that it's very often defended in the name of the poor. I mean, it's really interesting that, you know, the way you framed it in terms of, you know, this startup in Finland is much more important than 2 billion peasants.
Right.
But the way that it's often framed is, yeah, but this startup in Finland is actually going to help the 2 billion peasants, whereas, you know, you're some sort of crazy homesteader that wants to take us all back to the dark ages. And I think, I mean, I hate, you know, I always try and get avoid that sort of debate, whereas a kind of basically wealthy white Westerner arguing with another wealthy white Westerner about who cares more about the global poor. I mean, it's not an edifying debate to have. But I think, you know, I think we just need to find resources to refuse that debate and to kind of and basically to say, you know, do you really think you're solving all these people's problems, or, you know, should we look to them themselves to, you know, to be part of the debate and to actually be you know, addressing? I mean, because ultimately it's about localism. It's not about some sort of global one-size-fits-all solution. It's about people actually, again, that word agency, having agency and local autonomy to kind of, to exert some control over their lives, I guess.
Well, in one way that I found myself talking about this as I've taken the book out into the world is to go, you know, a lot of it hangs on what we think is at stake in the ending of the world as we know it. Because that's, you know, the final lines of the Dark Mountain Manifesto pretty much were the end of the world as we know it is not the end of the world, full stop. And in a sense, this book, At Work in the Ruins, is kind of, you know, a 200-page unpacking of that statement, you could say. Because, you know, if we have absorbed the story, you know, what Paul and I called the myth of progress in the Dark Mountain Manifesto, the story that the way that some of us have been living around here lately represents the great achievement towards which the whole of human history has been pointing, then we will seek to defend that achievement at all costs, no matter how dreadful or, you know, those costs are, no matter how improbable the things that we're betting on are. And, you know, every other TED talk has one of those kind of upward sweeping curves of progress that, you know, reinforce this message that the whole of human history has all been pointing to us now. So, like, defusing that story, saying it's not that there's no truth in what Hans Rosling told you or Steven Pinker wants to tell you. It's that too much has to be hidden from the story in order to make those performances convincing, in order to make those narratives as persuasive as they seem to be on first blush. And for me, it was, you know, it was thinkers from the global south. It was hearing Vandana Shiva speak in Cape Town when I was 22. It was, you know, going to Oaxaca and meeting Gustavo Esteva, the founder of Unitierra. It was these people and reading lots of other thinkers and activists who've been involved in grassroots peasant movements around the world that gave me the confidence to kind of call the bluff of that thing that you're describing, Chris, which actually reproduces a very colonial dynamic in, you know, in its insistence on the need for the white saviors from Finland I live in Sweden, so I get to make jokes about Finland. My mother-in-law is Finnish. I hope she's not watching this. But I've derailed myself now.
I might jump in. So the one thing that I do, I think there are a set of heuristics, maybe not solutions, but I could probably write, and probably should write, like a list of heuristics that you should be tending toward if you want, if you're like interested in a solution. And I think those are, you know, sort of localism, local self-determination, but also working with your hands and doing something with your hands, being more present and agentic in your own life, like realizing that, you know, whatever kind of track you're on, whether you're professional, managerial class, or working class, like that there are options still within these different tracks to live differently. But there's, you know, there's options to do things like downshifting, which is like consume less, work less hours, be more, you have more free time, you know, these different kinds of approaches. But I think my research, I'm very interested in what gets people go, like asking these questions and actually going in this direction. And I'm a kind of historical materialist. I don't know whether or not you agree, but I kind of feel like people start going in this direction when they have to, when they reach some sort of crisis point. And a lot of times the crisis point isn't clearly something like climate change. It's like a breaking point in that industrial, like the machine has placed on them. It's in one way or another. And then they have to rethink everything. And for me, I'm really interested in sort of being the people who have sort of worked through this alternative path, becoming not necessarily non-modern or postmodern, but like some different kind of person by doing things differently, doing things more with our hands, engaging more with community, and then kind of lending a hand back. Like, okay, you've reached this crisis point. I've been there before. Here's what I would suggest as first steps for you and your particular situation. I don't know. Have you been thinking about that kind of role at all?
Yeah, no, that resonates with me. And I mean, I'm sitting here in our school called Home, and we always say that it's a gathering place for those who are drawn to the work of regrowing a living culture. And there's a lot packed into those words, but you know, some of the things that those words can point to include some of the things that you've just been mapping out, and you know, not least the kind of working with your hands thing, because part of what goes missing in the kind of the TED Talk version of the narrative of progress is that simultaneously with producing certain kinds of extraordinary, previously unimaginable abundance, utterly unsustainable abundance, modernity has also produced these new kinds of helplessness. This is what Illich was very good at describing, mm-hmm. that we end up with these kinds of human beings who resemble none of our ancestors anywhere until very recently, because until very recently, humans anywhere in the world, as part of their local cultures, had to hold the skills at individual, household, and community level of building our own homes, feeding each other, growing the food, making the food, caring for the sick, burying the dead. You know, and yes, there have been advances in specific areas in many of those things which produce statistically impressive results in modernity. But if that whole project of modernity was radically unsustainable, then when someone waves those impressive statistics at you, your job is not to surrender to the narrative that they want to use those statistics to support. It's to say, right, so some of the work, some of what is to be done is to move downwards to the specific, to go, what is it that we've learned? What is it that we know that people didn't know 200 years ago that has made such a difference to the number of mothers surviving childbirth and the number of children living to be 10 years old? And how much of that can we find ways of carrying forward into hard times? And, you know, there's actually kind of quite hopeful evidence once you start digging in that area, because, you know, there was a study, I think it's not from 1992, by the Center for Disease Control, of all people, which looked at the increase in life expectancy in the US from 1900 to 1990. You had a 30-year increase in life expectancy at birth. Only 5 years of that are down to hospital medicine. Most of the other 25 are down to public health. That's really good news because hospital medicine is based on very expensive, precarious stacks of technology that it's very easy to lose. And, you know, just talk to, you know, doctors who think about antibiotic resistance, and they'll tell you how much of that stack can go purely down to the failure of antibiotics. If that was where all of that increase in life expectancy had come from, we'd be in far worse trouble. A lot of the stuff that makes up the public health contribution to that increase in life expectancy consists of things that we have learned that can be turned into vernacular knowledge and practice that can be carried way beyond and have been carried way beyond the reach of high-tech Western hospitals. So we have to reskill, not in some kind of freezing things at some moment in the past that was when it was all fine and golden, reskilling to that. It does involve learning lots of the things that our ancestors knew how to do that we've forgotten. It also includes having a kind of clear-eyed approach to the achievements of modernity. And this is kind of where I end the book, is with this sort of back of an envelope list that might help people find their answers that are not once and for all answers, but for me and for here and for now and with those around me answers to the what do you do question. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you know, look for the good things that we have a chance of salvaging where you might be in a position to contribute to getting to bring this skill or this species or this body of knowledge or whatever it is with us through the bottleneck we're headed into. Mm-hmm. Look for the good things that we're not going to get to bring with us and mourn them. And in the act of mourning, tell the stories so that we carry the stories with us, because some of those stories may turn out to be seeds in worlds that we can't imagine yet. Look for the things that were never as good as we told each other they were, and the chance we're being given to notice that and let go of things that have been, you know, that we've been attached to and that we've seen as necessary around here lately. And then look for the dropped threads from earlier in the story that there's a chance of weaving back in. And the most exciting thing for me since the book came out is that Richard Smith, who's the former editor of the British Medical Journal, not only did he write a really lengthy and, you know, very enthusiastic review of the book in the BMJ, but in the closing part of that review, he took that back of an envelope map of the four kinds of tasks for an age of endings and applied it to the field of medicine. Wow. Based on his 50 years of experience of being at the center of the field of medicine. I'm like, oh, right. I hadn't realized I'd done that. But if one of the things this book is doing is giving people tools they can take into the heart of their professional communities to do a kind of work of triage on modernity, rather than these kind of misplaced kind of romanticizing the future narratives of modernity that, you know, a lot of the people who you come up against, Chris, in the debates that I see you getting into are peddling, then that could be a hopeful contribution. And I'm sure there are lots of other tools like that that we could be improvising and trying out and giving to people who see some of what we're seeing and who are embedded within or capable of moving in and out of and operating with authority within existing structures.
Just a quick follow up on that. I like, I mean, the notion of romanticizing the future is one that I've used quite a bit, and I think it's a good one, along with spreadsheet brain and many of the other ideas in your book, Dougal. I think it's good because we always talk about romanticizing the past, and I mean, the whole, well, I talk about it a little bit in my forthcoming book, the whole way we, you know, that we invoke the romantic movement is really problematic. But if we are going to talk about romanticizing things as problematic, you know, definitely we need to look at the way we romanticize the future. But that kind of leads into another question, which in what you've just said, you were touching on it, but maybe just to bring it out a little bit more. I mean, death is a big theme in your book in various ways. The death of us as individuals, but also the death of cultures. And I think, I can't remember, somewhere, you know, you talk about that quite explicitly, and the fact that, you know, modernity, you know, one, perhaps the biggest failing of modernity is its inability to face death. So obviously I was at the event that you, where Richard Smith that you mentioned was there, and that was really interesting, as you say, that a lot of people with healthcare backgrounds who are kind of alienated from a kind of medical model of, you know, keeping people alive at all costs of me, are sort of interested in this. So I just wondered if you would, yeah, want to say a little bit more about death as a as an either as an individual or a cultural phenomenon, and what we're getting wrong about that.
Yeah, I mean, death is woven through the book and deep in the heart of it, because it's woven through life and deep in the heart of life. And I've been listening to the audiobook of the book that Nick Cave and Shauna Hagen have done together, which is Faith, Hope and Carnage, which is extraordinary. And to have someone with the kind of artistic gifts that Nick Cave has, who has gone through this personal horrific trauma and loss, you know, his 15-year-old son died under the most horrible circumstances, and who has then just allowed himself to be publicly broken open. And I've seen it, seeing him on stage in recent years, but also reading the Red Hand Files and now listening to this book of his conversations. There is an extraordinary power when we allow death back from the curtain it's been hidden behind in modern societies. And when we start to tell that story, of course, we have to, you know, in telling it, we have to acknowledge that part of the reason why death has been hidden from view in modernity is because of, you know, some of those achievements in medicine and public health that we wouldn't gladly lose. But that's not the whole story. And we also have to look at the deformations that are the other side of the way that we have handled those achievements. And, you know, I say in the book, I quote Stephen Jenkinson, who's somebody else who has a huge amount of direct knowledge of working with death and writes very eloquently about the death phobic societies of the modern West. And I say at a point, I think that environmentalism has been haunted by this. I think Western environmentalism, born into the middle of such a culture in the mid 20th century, has inevitably carried on some of the habits of that. And therefore, when we're talking about the fragile earth, some of that fragility is a kind of projection of our own undealt with fear of our own mortality. When we're talking about extinction, some of the resonance of the way we're talking about it is a displacement from that kind of unremarkable personal extinction that is waiting for each of us somewhere down the road. And just in the way that is just borne witness to by Nick Cave's work over the last few years, and, you know, and by Stephen Jenkinson's work, and, you know, and by some of the conversations and some of the things that happened around loss and grief within the new shape of the activism that emerged in 2018-19, that had a very different flavor to it than earlier climate activism, we see some of the power that comes back. We don't get to be grown-ups without having been confronted close up with our own mortality. And that's, again, looking at the ways in which humans have made life work in other times and places, looking at the shape of initiations as described by people from tribal cultures, as described by historians and anthropologists. We know that in so many times and places, it's been understood that humans are born, but grown-ups are made, and making grown-ups is the work of culture. And in societies that had that looked vastly poor by the standards of the spreadsheet mind, an extraordinary amount of the resources of the societies have gone into these cultural processes and activities and rituals, including the ones which bring young people across the threshold from childhood into the first phase of adulthood. And again in those rituals. And if you want a place to start to get some pictures of this, Maladoma Somed's book of Water and the Spirit is a really extraordinary personal account from Burkina Faso. But what he describes and what you find in descriptions from other cultures is this real confrontation and real kind of high risk confrontation with a dramatized experience of an encounter with the reality of your own death as part of what teenagers have gone through, so that they can be on the path to being able to show up as contributing grown-ups within the life of their community, rather than helpless, dependent beings in the way that many of us are left when we're sent out into society and, according to the law of the land, we've come of age, but we've not been given any of the things that might equip us for that. And so I think, given that human cultures have almost always laid far greater emphasis on this stuff than we have done around here lately in modernity, and given that those human cultures have had to weather hard times, you know, whenever people come to me and they go, you know, Dugald, I want to have a conversation with you about making decisions about having children in the Anthropocene, because they know what I write about. They know that I'm a father. And one of the things I say to them is, look, you know, I understand the different things that you're thinking about. But one thing I will say is that for all the things that are new and strange about where we're headed into, the choice to bring children into a world under conditions of great uncertainty, of not knowing that you're going to be able to guarantee their safety and security and provide for them. Like, how many of your ancestors brought children into the world under those conditions? You're not alone in that. And that's part of what I mean about picking up the dropped threads. It's not romanticizing the ways that people have lived in the past. It's recognizing precisely that they had to live with hard times that we don't want to think about, that are not so different in some ways to the hard times that plenty of other people whose lives are connected to ours by global supply chains right now are living in the middle of. That there are hard times lying ahead for us and our descendants, and therefore we need to start taking seriously these things that have been neglected while we could afford to have societies of overgrown children, while we could afford to be uninitiated.
I love this metaphor of needing to grow up through some sort of initiation ritual, and I would even argue that because so much of the work of our existence and life is outsourced to like the global marketplace, that that's kind of behind this sort of extended adolescence. And I would suggest, just having been a mother, just going through the process of being pregnant and having a child, without any drugs, there was this moment for me, at least, of like a embodiedness that then like thrust me into adulthood. Like, I mean, there is a moment where you don't know whether or not your baby will live or die, or you will live or die. And this, it's just so raw, and everybody else in history is, every other mother in history has gone through it, but you're like, you're in that moment, and it's like embracing your mortality and the mortality of this act to be able to, have the species continue. And I think it's also true with little things. Like, we moved onto this property and our cat hunts mice outside, and my little kids see that, they're like, oh my God. Like, at first, you know, such a shocking thing to see death, up close like that. But now, because it's normalized, and you recognize it's a part of life, that is a kind of maturity, and responsibility that comes with that. Like, just sort of recognizing that for yourself to exist, your flesh, you need, you know, something else to die in the world. It's hugely important. And I just wanted to share a brief anecdote. One friend of the show is this guy, Tucker Max, who wrote these like kind of debauched books, you know, 10, 15 years ago. And kind of has come on this arc where he's now a family man and has this ranch. And he wrote this long article about going with his family to slaughter and process a bison, and how it was this hugely spiritual experience. And the kids saw it, and there was like a prayer before slaughtering the animal. And I would just suggest that one way there is to just get into these embodied experiences, because there's really only so much you can describe until you get into some sort of situation. Even if you do something like keep chickens, like, you're responsible for this other little creature You're keeping them alive and you're living off of their eggs. Sometimes if you slaughter them, you're living off of their body, and like managing that ecology is actually a whole different mindset than, yeah, I mean, I think than just approaching life where you're not responsible for those things. I think there is like a sort of extended adolescence tied up with not acknowledging the life and death aspect. Not really a question there. Sorry. Just any thoughts?
No, I was just letting that land, because that's, yeah, absolutely. Having been in the room as a father, playing the bit part that you play during that process of birth, that was one of the things that was powerfully brought home to me. That I mean, my boss at the time I was working at the Swedish National Theatre, because their artistic director had got massively freaked out about climate change and spent 2 years reading books about it. And then after 2 years, he found his way to the Dark Mountain Manifesto. And he said something changed when he read that. And so then he discovered that I was living in Sweden. He invited me in for a conversation. I ended up going and working with him for 2 years. And he was a few years older than me, and he had two children. And he said to me just before I went on paternity leave, he said, it's the most animal experience that you can have, like being around birth. And he was absolutely right about that. But what I was not fully ready for, although if I had listened to, the indigenous folks and ecofeminists and mythographers that I had been around over the years, I could have been ready for it maybe, was that it's also the most mythic experience. Mm-hmm. That the kind of time shifts between the phases of birth, the arc of that journey, exactly what you just described, the way in which it absolutely is, an archetype of an initiatory journey, is like, it's one of those reminders that like myth is not this thing over here that is right. Created by these weird monkeys with not a lot of hair and who use their mouths a lot. Myth is entirely enmeshed with and emergent from the animal bodily nature of what it's like to be creatures in a world like this. And we get to express it in particular ways as humans. But it is also expressed in bodies. It's expressed in experiences like birth and death. And, that's part of, like, to the extent that modernity has cut us off from any awareness of that, that's somehow very closely connected to the way in which it has rendered us helpless and, like sort of axolotls that never actually mature into salamanders, that we've created this kind of perpetual adolescence quality. And if we are going to challenge the enormous structures that we're up against, and we're not going to challenge them on the terms that they think power works, but we are going to be involved in processes which are in some sense a challenge to them. I love the assertion at the end of your book, Chris, that actually that whole Goldman Sachs doesn't care if we keep chickens, it's not that simple. Like, Goldman Sachs might not be able to recognize the subversive implications of you keeping chickens, but we have to tap into chthonic and mythic layers of power in order to stand our ground against the forces that are operating within history that we're going to be up against as things get harder. And I feel like that was brought home to me by going back to the UK for a few weeks with this book and going around talking to lots of people and, firstly, just seeing how hard times are already here in lots of people's lives, in lots of communities, but also seeing this kind of upwelling and kind of coming together of art and activism, drawing on very deep pre-modern roots. Mm-hmm. If I just like to take the one example that has had quite a bit of publicity, the land protests on Dartmoor over wild camping, which is a kind of one of the front lines of these land struggles, but also everything that Nick Hayes has done with the Book of Trespass, which has opened up a much wider conversation in England about land. I mean, England's been way behind Scotland on that for decades, but the way in which these kind of mythic archetypal figures are being invoked and the way, the kind of extraordinary art that is being made, and the sort of the sense that there is a fusion of stuff that, you know, I think Paul Kingsnorth kind of saw this coming almost before anybody, and Jez Butterworth and Mark Rylance when they created Jerusalem, and it's there in Martin Shaw's work and the School of Myth and so on. And that's just the blokes, most of whom I happen to know, who I'm talking about. And there are all sorts of amazing women who are on fire and visionaries who I could be naming as well. You know, storytellers like Rachel Rose Reed and artists like Vanessa Chamberlain. But I just see where in the 90s, yeah, you might have had the Rhodes protests that were kind of tapping some of this land energy in a way that was not common in activism and was very powerful for people like Paul or like Jay Griffiths who were involved in it. At the same time, the art world then was so far away from that. It was like the young British artists and Damien Hirst and so on. Whereas now I meet these like key figures in the arts in the UK, and they're like, yeah, we just spent the afternoon writing hymns for a climate protest. And like, it's not just that they're engaged with a climate protest, it's that they think that what might be called for is something like a hymn. Mm. And it's that sense of really unexpected upwellings and crossings of different currents that's going on now that I think we need to be able to tap into. And that was a strange path to go off onto, wasn't it? But it's all part of the mix.
I guess maybe I'm struggling to formulate a question. I think I have a question somewhere. And embodiment is something we've talked about a lot this evening, which I think is important. You know, whether we're talking about helplessness, you know, knowing how to use tools, knowing how to make our environment in some way, or those really powerful forms of embodiment like childbirth, or sort of, you know, like attaching to our animal nature rather than assuming that, you know, we live in this kind of digital world, and you know, and I kind of feel that as a writer as well. It's very well, I suppose that's what, yeah, maybe I have two questions for you. One question is, I think it's quite easy in as you know, writing, humans, you know, humans are great at inventing these symbolic systems, you know, language, money, all these sort of things, and they're very easy for us to alienate ourselves from the, you know, from the wider ecology, from the other plants and animals and the physical world. So I think there's a kind of double-edged thing there with myth, where we need to be careful about the kinds of myths that we're creating, because I mean we talked a lot about modernity, or you know, money is a myth. And maybe part of that also is, you know, it's interesting what you were just saying about the land movement in Britain, which, you know, and I think interesting things are happening. But again, I suppose from a farming perspective, I kind of think, and again, you know, Ashley was talking about that in terms of looking after chickens, or, you know, my thing about Goldman Sachs and chickens. It's kind of like access to land is such a huge issue in Britain historically, and so it's so important for people to be able to access land. But we've almost, like, a lot of people, you know, don't really know what to do with land. You know, it's like we have to feed and clothe ourselves. You know, we have to have a kind of structured practice of livelihood making, and it feels like we haven't quite got there yet. In these debates, and to me it's like really important that we get there quick, because, you know, because we know what's coming down the line. So I suppose, you know, a couple of questions about the ways in which myths can empower, or can or can deceive maybe, and how we move, you know, into a conversation about land, which is about, you know, really being part of a local human ecology, where, you know, we have to relate to the land and think about the other organisms in it, but really be generating livelihoods in, you know, in the landscape.
Yeah. Well, I think on the second one, I kind of just want to say, yeah, I agree. And I think it matters to bring that into focus, and also to try and join up between the places where people are, you know, at grassroots working on reskilling and livelihoods. And I mean, I think of, you know, I touch on it in the book, Bentley Urban Farm in one of the old pit villages outside of Doncaster, where they took over the disused horticultural college and, you know, have turned it into this community food and culture hub. And it's got this, it's very much a kind of a culture of making rather than a culture of consuming. And that's part of what we're talking about there, is like the access to land can't just be access to consume the land. It has to be access to get involved with the life of, you know, to get involved with the living world, to get involved with livelihoods, and, you know, in the fullness of what that word implies. And then, you know, on the kind of myth and language question, I think that yes, we need to retain a certain kind of what's the three H's that Vanessa Machado de Oliveira has? She talks about humor, humility, and hyper self-reflexivity. And I think like the last one is deliberately kind of absurd, but to point to the importance of practices of laughing at ourselves and questioning ourselves rather than getting high on our own kind of supply of ideas and language and so on. But I also think alongside that, not fully buying into some of these modern and postmodern ideas about the nature of language. And, you know, that's why I spoke about that visceral connection between the animal and the mythic in the experience of birth. Like affirming that what is carried within myth when it works is not simply some human layer that's created over the top that might be a good map or might be a bad map. But something that's actually rather more deeply enmeshed and participating in a living world rather than standing above it and telling a story about it. And, you know, that's really strange territory to go into. But that's where you find yourself if you, and again, a bit like what I was saying with how you can go to this, you can find paths from modernity to identifying the problem with the spreadsheet brain via different bodies of work and different people's kind of academic or cultural or intellectual projects. In the same way, I think you can find paths to, you know, an understanding of language as something that is rather more strangely entangled with the living world rather than a radically other human imposition on the living world. And you can get there from David Abraham's work in sort of philosophy and animism and phenomenology, or you can get there from Owen Barfield's stuff on the origins of language and this curious thing that, you know, we tend to think that language starts as literal description and then gets expanded to the metaphorical and the poetic and so on, but that actually the evidence is it's the other way around. Literal description is a very weird, culturally specific, hard to do use of language produced by modernity. Language arises in metaphor and myth and the poetic. And, you know, and again, can go into the archaeology. Stephen Mithen has a book which is exploring the idea or the likelihood that we were singing before we were speaking, that song precedes language. And I feel like all of this kind of deepening, I mean, I think as well of Rob Percival's The Meat Paradox is a kind of wonderful, thoughtful book that kind of starts in the kind of often not very fruitful kind of clashes on Twitter over, our vegan future versus the regenerative herd keeping future. And when I read that, I wrote, you know, Rob does for meat what David Graeber did for debt, you know, take something that is a fraught contemporary question and give us this much bigger cultural and historical and anthropological perspective in which to start making sense of what might be missing from the arguments we're usually having over it. So, you know, I do agree that, you know, I've been quite resistant to, for example, to Dark Mountain being identified as a romantic project, because I think there is a kind of, there is a dangerous field of, you know, as I say, kind of getting high on romantic and mythic material. There is a need for that kind of self-reflexivity, but I think that there's also like not allowing the story to be that, you know, there is this hard material layer of reality that is described by science, and then culture is some kind of soft comfort blanket that humans create for themselves up here, recognizing that culture is actually more like a sort of tectonic force, or like something that has some kind of mycelial entanglement that goes deep below the human layer into the tangle of the living world, to me is one of the things that we need to assert. And the reason we need to assert it, I think, is because there's power that will come from that. People who are coming alive are they get the attention of those around them. They show signs of the possibility that things could be other than they are, in a way that marks them out from the state that many of us have spent much of our lives in the kinds of societies we were born in, the state that you almost have to go into to operate in some of the spaces of these societies. I feel myself going into that state when I go into Stockholm, into the very bright, busy urban environment some of the time. But we, you know, if we can, tap these energies without being naive about the toxic deformations that can go on when people are, you know, attempting to invoke those things, then I think that's where some of the power and the resilience that we're going to need for, you know, the kind of stumbling onwards together into the hard times ahead might come from. But yeah, what I wouldn't want to be advocating for is, you know, building big stories that try and, you know, get people to subsume their identities beneath some big mythic project. That's not a living way of working with this stuff, is it?
No, that's a great answer. I mean, I like your idea of, you know, of language being entangled with the living world. I mean, and I think particularly it's a danger with, you know, the old spreadsheet brain or kind of non-fiction writing. You know, you mentioned some of my, you know, some of my arguments with the eco-modernists, where there's this kind of opposition between the empirical and the mystical or whatever, which I think is really problematic. But I think, you know, it's easy if you're writing a kind of, you know, a non-fiction sort of piece or a piece of journalism, it's easy to kind of solve in words problems that are actually insoluble in real life. So, or, you know, not that they're not well, you know, solubility is a whole problem. You know, it's not that we can't find a way through, orient ourselves to them, but it's kind of like it's using that kind of symbolic system like language in a way that isn't, as you say, kind of entangled with the, you know, the greater complexity and the open endedness of the wider world.
I would just add, though, I don't think it's, I rail on against spreadsheet brain a lot, but I also think there is a tendency, and I've seen this happen a lot, to also do this with fiction and myth and or picking and choosing from other cultures and making we had a couple of people on the podcast who had these like eco village projects that were like galaxy brain, you know, we've figured it all out. Like we're going to have an ecological society and it's going to be based on like the mythology of all these different cultures. And it's like, I'm sorry, no, this is so theoretical. You don't just get to pick and choose like this many things at once and design it in advance. Like that just isn't how it works. Like, and there's no education that's as impactful in my experience. And I'm sure Chris, you've been through this, than just meeting natural limits to your theoretical ideology about how things are going to work on your homestead or whatever. I think it's incredibly important to hammer home that we've seen actually in the doomer optimism sphere, some people who are like, were hugely impactful to us. You know, they end up just going to live in some like eco village in Costa Rica. That's just like reifying a lot of the same kind of like you know, it's not really engaging with ecology. It's just like, oh, we're just going to have this like nice fantasy life with a bunch of other expats in a gated community. It's like, oh, okay, I guess suburbia was really just the suburbia in Costa Rica was really just the answer all along. You know, we really do need to remake these myths ourselves through experience, like checking them through our own experience and like building out that intuition again, like trusting my own experience. Giving birth made me like and being a mother made me like you know, have a bunch of critical thoughts about industrial birth, you know, processes in the United States. But it was because I was like in touch with my own instinct, like this is just not right. This is the way it should be done. My experience says so. This natural limit. And the question I have for you based on this mini rant is, I've been to a couple of events lately where it's like, you know, hippie type events that are like slightly back to the land type stuff. And it seems like everybody's kind of just like picking and choosing different myths, like I said, you know, and picking and choosing different practices. Like some of it is ecstatic dance. Some of it is, and like, you know, none of it, it's like, there's no coherence to it. Cause it's all just like, whatever people feel like they wanted to res or whatever's like cool in the hippie community at the moment.
Yeah.
And I wonder whether or not there is some, I know I've heard you talk about this, and I wonder whether or not, I know Paul has turned towards religion, like whether or not there is some sort of truth in, like, you know, looking at our own religious history as like a coherent potential mythology. It's almost like in these hippie circles, you can talk about every other type of spirituality besides Christianity as if there's like nothing good there just because it's the one you're from. So I'm just wondering if you're thinking about that at all, how your thinking is at the moment on this topic.
Right. Yeah. So I, firstly, going back a couple of steps, you know, a culture isn't a thing that's designed. Culture is not something that's created by design. And again, like coming out of, seen through the lenses of modernity, it can be hard for people to conceive of how you can have agency without a process of design,
right,
without a kind of projected intention that's being deliberately extended into the world, or extended downwards into the world is probably the direction in which to do that gesture. And, you know, equally, a culture is not constructed by a kind of supermarket sweep of running around picking what looks shiny. A culture is something far more pragmatic than that. It arises from the need to navigate things like birth, things like the need to feed ourselves. You know, part of the difficulty that is going on at the moment is that, you know, there's a kind of let's pretend quality, a make-believe quality necessarily to a lot of these attempts. And we need to like actually have that in view. That's part of what the hyper-self-reflexivity looks like, I guess,
yep.
Is, you know, not pretending to ourselves that we're doing this with the stakes as they have been and will be again. You know, we know that we still have things we can fall back on that make the conditions of our lives very different to the conditions of plenty of other people's lives right now and of the lives of our ancestors and descendants. That doesn't mean that the kind of that doesn't mean that rehearsal and building capacity isn't a real and worthwhile thing to do. But you have to be really careful. I mean, I've always said that the one kind of authentic shamanic tradition that exists in a modern white urban context is stand-up comedy. I spent a couple of years around stand-up clubs in my late 20s and, you know, watching the good performers and the people who failed and the people who succeeded the easy way and the people who succeeded doing the really hard stuff. But what I saw was that anyone who succeeded, whether they were doing it the cheap way or the hard way, was actually taking the consciousness of a room full of people who hadn't come along having paid £500 for a shamanic drumming weekend and therefore kind of willing it to be real, but right, who come along and start there going, you know, right, go on then, show us what you can do. And your first job as the comedian is single-handedly to fuse together the consciousness of that room full of people and then to ride it and see where you can push it. And it's a remarkable thing once you tune into what's actually going on in those rooms. And as I say, like a lot of what is labeled shamanism in a modern white context, even before you get to the problems of cultural appropriation, just has a fundamental issue, which is that it's like battle reenactment pretending to be actual soldiers.
Yes.
And you know, you can do training for battle without pretending that the battle has started yet. But that's not the same thing as being the person who spends all day dressed in the clothes from the army surplus store, play acting that they're in the middle of a war zone. And like, maybe those kind of distinctions might help us a bit.
Yeah.
And like, what do I want to say about, I think that there is a kind of a theological turn going on.
Yeah.
Within people who've been deeply involved in environmentalism. And I mean, it's interesting, again, like reading Nick Cave's book alongside all of this, because for him, it's not coming out of any particular involvement with environmentalism or climate movements. It's something that's clearly been there in the background culturally for him and artistically for him, but is transformed firstly through the experience of recovery from substance abuse, and then secondly, through the experience of horrific loss and grief and the need to survive it. And through the middle of all of those things, he is very willing to talk about God. And I'm surprised, actually, you know, I've been around plenty of spaces in alternative culture over the years where, as you say, people are willing to enthuse about anything apart from something that, you know, has a foot within the cultural lineage that they themselves are born into. And there can be good reasons for that, not least within people's personal experience or the histories of the kind of colonial and imperial versions of these religions. But there is something going on now where people are willing to talk in a different way. Whether they're, you know, actually having the kind of experience that somebody like Paul or Martin Shaw, for that matter, has had of a kind of radical eruption of an encounter with Christianity in midlife, or just I see other versions of it that are simply a kind of a more sober is a useful word for it, a more sober recognition that this is, whether you like it or not, the cultural root out of which you have grown and which has shaped your experience of the world. And it might be worth being a bit less arrogant in the way you treat the traditions of your ancestors than has been fashionable in progressive circles in recent times, let's say. And I think this is stuff that I want to explore further. I was in Paris on my way back from the trip to the UK, and I got to hang out for an evening, like, firstly with this project called Black Elephant that I've been kind of connected to for a couple of years, which is growing out of people who have direct experience of Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12-step fellowships and the kind of power of the vulnerability and of people with nothing in common other than their addictions who meet and become powerful influences on each other's lives in the rooms of those fellowships. And you know, they will talk about the role of giving your life over to a higher power. Within the language of Alcoholics Anonymous, they've often talked about, you know, God as you understand God, like, as in not having to take on anyone else's understanding of God, but needing nonetheless to put something in that place so you're not putting yourself or something else that's smaller in that place in order to make the journey that leads to recovery. And Nick Cave talks about that in his book, and he talks about, you know, something can be true enough, and that might sound wishy-washy, but when you've seen people's lives saved by their journeys in recovery, then true enough becomes actually, you know, a powerful and pragmatic thing. So firstly, I was at this Black Elephant dinner in Paris, experiencing these attempts that this kind of network of people, some of whom come out of AA and 12-step, are trying to find ways of sharing that with the rest of us, not least in the face of the climate crisis and the trouble that the world is in. But then I was hanging out with Reed Wildermuth, who's one of my favorite, definitely not Christian writers. I don't know if you know him, but he's pagan, political, what does he call himself? Pagan Marxist theorist of the political and the sacred. He lives in Luxembourg and has plenty to say about his own experiences of growing up around particular versions of Christianity in the US. But he wrote something out of the conversation we had that I found very striking, that came out on Substack the other day in this series called The Mysteria that he's been writing on his From the Forests of Arduino Substack. And he said, you know, if the Christians ever go back to the wild, then I would defend them with my life. And that came out of his mouth at 1 o'clock in the morning as we were sitting having this conversation in Paris. And he said it sort of followed him home and he was stuck with the truth of this and had to write about how he could possibly have said it. And part of where he's coming from is he's saying, like, if you're starting in a European context, this is the cultural material. This is like what your villages have been organized around. It's what you've got to work with. And therefore, while it's not my path, I will support people on that path because right. It might be part of what's called for. And that, you know, Rebecca Bandt is somebody else who writes interestingly about this. And I heard her talk about sort of ancestral Christianity, which is a strange thing since Christianity hasn't necessarily been that keen on ancestors in the way that other cultural traditions have, but that maybe part of where some of us need to start from is acknowledging that we stand within an ancestral tradition of Christianity rather than attempting to claim the big universal narratives that Christianity in its missionary imperial mode has attempted to project out onto the whole world, that just at this moment in time, a humbler kind of ancestral relationship to, well, this is what I was given by the people I came from, might be part of what some of us need to work with.
Chris, do you want to take one last, make one last comment, and I can make one last one?
I mean, I suppose maybe there's something in different parts of this discussion about the sort of longevity of culture, sort of beyond our own lifetimes and, you know, further back from our own lifetimes that we've been touching on. I mean, you know, when I asked you earlier about, you know, when people say, so what's your plan? I think part of what, you know, in response to Ash's question, part of what you were saying is to refuse that kind of, you know, just pick off the supermarket shelf, you know, if we're going to get through what's coming, you know where we are, it's going to be kind of slow culture. It's going to be a process, a long-term process that is much beyond any of our individual lifetimes, but also a process where we have to connect a little bit with, you know, the what's available culturally from the past in a way that, you know, modernity, I mean, I suppose we come back to modernity, that it's been this, you know, self-conscious break with the past and trying to, and again, you know, these ideas of helplessness and adolescence, it's kind of living in this eternal present rather than, you know, rather than that more sort of humble process of being part of, you know, building a long-term culture. So I just, you know.
Yeah. And I would just add, I think like maybe part of what I'm hearing and something that has been, we're sort of like making it up as we go along, this whole doomer optimism thing, so I don't really know what's emerging, but I just now had a realization with both of you talking that there is a kind of like possibility for a radical counter ecology that's not really represented anywhere else, that is a kind of like radically non-judgmental, radically tolerant, but also radically skeptical of any of the above. Like, I will even embrace spreadsheets as a tool that's part of my lineage. I will embrace, like, you know, all these different
right.
potential tools, but they need to be used correctly. They need to be tested against reality, and my tools don't have to be yours. And so there's like also a radical localist tendency to it. Like, maybe my particular mix of what I've come up with that makes sense for me and or I'm sharing with people around me and resonates with them is going to be completely different with what other mix somebody else comes up with, and I really don't need to have a say about their mix is, and you know, it's just sort of meta modern approach. I don't know if that, and I don't know if you have any last thoughts you wanted to share before we wrap up.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not that into this kind of language of meta modernity, really, because to me, I think what we're at is, whether it's hospicing modernity in Vanessa's language, or, you know, I was thinking as you were saying that, it's kind of composting modernity, like releasing the resources held within these big dead trees of the existing systems, because it's time for the mother tree to fall and give that back to the forest. And that doesn't mean that we need to go in with a chainsaw and fell all the trees of the big systems. That's not what's called for. But there is a, you know, within modernity, on the one hand, you know, riffing off what you were just saying, Chris, there's been a kind of disdain for tradition and the idea that we have anything to learn from the past. And at the same time, also a reifying of tradition. Like, modernity constructs tradition as its other, as this timeless, unchanging, reactionary thing. And I remember Gustavo Esteva saying to me, in Mexico, we have a great tradition of changing our traditions traditionally. And so recovering that kind of, recovering the recognition that tradition has always been carried through composting rather than through, you know, preserving in aspic. That yeah, preserving of tradition is actually what museums that are an invention of modernity do. It's not what living cultures do. And therefore we have to, you know, have the kind of the freedom of recognizing the weirdness of how culture comes alive and continues, including the kind of friendly pagan druid who's really not into Christianity, but going, you know, you guys are actually willing to take it back to the wild, then I'll defend you with my life. That's not just some weird postmodern kind of hybrid to be treated with suspicion. That's a lot of what it looked like in the Middle Ages as well. Here you have the north door of the church, which is the one through which the people enter for the rituals to which the priest is not invited. Look into those traditions, the devil's door, and you begin to see how much culture on the ground has not resembled the kind of fantasies of purity that modernity projects onto tradition and then produces in its most horrific manifestations, that actually there's always a kind of messy hybrid quality, but that doesn't mean that you don't know where you stand. It's not about kind of being wishy-washy and treating everything as just, we're all just saying the same thing with different words. No, we can have real kind of hard pragmatic differences in what we're seeing and saying and doing, and we have to figure out how to rub along together and make life work, just like our ancestors have had to do in so many times and places. And that's, you know, that's in the best case, that's the kind of future we're headed into. And that's not something that we do between now and 2030. That's something that we get involved in and don't live to see the end of the process of. And that is as it should be, because culture is meant to be a thing that outlasts any of us as individuals.
That's such a great note to end on. Thank you so much. This was so great. You are now deemed a Doomer Optimist, so you're in our club, so be our friend. And yeah, this is so wonderful. So thanks so much.